Today, senators defy the high priesthood of finance. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Robbie Boat from the Citizens Party. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, Martin.
Oh, we had some fun in the Senate estimates yesterday, didn't we?
We did. If people pay attention to the meat and potatoes of politics, it's actually quite exciting. Last night was one of those occasions. The Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank had to appear before the Senate again. It's a new phenomenon. Didn't have to do it for a long time. And he's finding the going not so easy.
Well, I think it's quite interesting that this is a relatively new thing, you know, and it's, I guess, beginning to hold the Reserve Bank a bit more accountable, because rather than just a few Dorothy Dixon questions, there were some really meaty questions, not just from one, but from several players. And in fact, what I want to do with you is to just go through some of the highlights and, you know, we can almost sort of score the conversations, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who were the winners? Who were the losers? What were the issues? Because it really does show that the superficial sort of visage of the Reserve Bank and what actually is going on is a bit different.
Oh, for sure. When you see the line of questioning to Guy Debelle last night, it is extraordinary to think they avoided that kind of question for a long, long time. Now it's become a habit. Senators are now expecting to get the Reserve Bank before Senate estimates. Though my understanding is the RBA is not under oath when they appear before Senate estimates. That's my understanding. Last time at Senate estimates, there was an appearance by the RBA. Two senators made Guy Debelle's life uncomfortable, and they were Jared Rennick, LNP Senator from Queensland, and One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts. Both of those put him on the spot over various aspects of RBA policy. This time, you're right, it expanded out. It was three. Now, Malcolm wasn't in the picture. I think he's not in Canberra at the moment, but Jared Rennick had another go. Nick McKim from the Greens had a go. And then National Party Senator Matt Canavan followed it up, and he had a go. And each of their line of questioning was very pointed. And what they're trying to get at, if you want to characterise it, is in these extraordinary circumstances of the global financial system relative to COVID, but also the ructions before that, you know, quantitative easing, all those phenomena that we've become used to in the global financial system, where's the results in the real world, right? And they went after him on the basis that the activities of the Reserve Bank are helping housing speculators for sure. What about the real economy? And that's, you know, that captures it. And I think this is something that the Reserve Bank will be thinking, this is getting a bit serious here. We are a high priesthood of finance. I mean, that's how they act. Central bankers are high priests of finance. They're untouchable. They got away with this con of independence, right? Which allowed them to make themselves unaccountable democratically. They've enjoyed that. Now, they might have got away with it for a while when it looked like they were getting results. But since it's in the last post GFC period, when everything's gone pear shaped, they still expect to be treated that way. And we're seeing signs in the Australian Parliament that members of Parliament, and especially these senators, are revolting. Well, that's what the RBA thinks of them anyway.
Yes, that's right. They certainly are revolting. And it's, look, really interesting. I think what we should do, let's just play a little bit of Jared Rennick's conversation first, because that really quite nicely sets the scene. And then we'll go on to the next bit, right? So let's just play a little bit of his conversation with Guy Debelle.
First question is in regards to our gold that sits in London vaults.
Yep.
I asked you some questions on notice about that last time. You said you've done two audits of our gold. I'm assuming that's in our history in the last 20 years. And both times you counted 7% of the stock and 9% of the stock. Has the RBA ever actually cited all of our 80 tonnes of gold at any one time when we purchased it or since we purchased it?
Well, when it was here, we did. But since it's been in London, then I think I'm pretty sure, and I will correct my answer if I have got this wrong, then I think the answer is no. We did sample audits, and fairly standard auditing practice when we did those two audits that you just referred to.
So
they were both sample audits.
When did it leave Australia?
I'll have to get back to you on that. This is before my time. I can't answer that question directly.
Why do you have to give 6 months' notice to do an audit of our gold?
I will have to answer. I'll have to come back to you on that question.
Because if we've got the serial numbers, I mean, you won't give them to me, but if you've got the serial numbers, you should just be able to rock up and go, here's our numbers, can you go and get them from the vaults? You know, it might take a couple of hours, but it can't be that hard. I mean, gold's a relative.
It can take more than a couple of hours for 80 tonnes.
No, but, you know, you shouldn't need 6 months either. I mean, it's either there or it isn't. So
sure.
I'm just concerned, you know, about where it is. I just find, because it's worth $6 billion, and I just find it quite strange that we have it in another country and we do an audit every 6 years.
I think that's pretty standard auditing practice. You would find Senator to do sample audits rather than
well actually audits occur every year. The stock take mightn't take every year.
No, I take that point.
Year.
But given
the fungible nature of gold, I would have thought we'd count 100% of it, not bits of it, because it's very easy, you know, to melt it down, you know, whatever. So and then I note that you won't release the audit reports to the public, and apparently there's an exemption under Freedom of Information because it's got to do with foreign affairs. Do you think that's really fair that the RBA won't release audit reports of our gold stock, given that it's worth $6 billion?
I will come back to you on that one, Senator, as to why we didn't release them.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, you gave me the reason. It said because it related to international relations and it contained material obtained in confidence. So I don't know what there is in confidence that you'd need about gold to, you know, why you just couldn't say, well, here it is, we counted it, tick. I mean, anyway, so if you get that back on notice, that'd be great. I also put a question on notice about whether you knew what the Plunge Protection Team was, which was the Working Group on Financial Markets, which is an organisation between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury groups in the States. It's probably fair to say that like the Europeans and like the Japanese and like the Chinese and all major economies, governments do intervene in the workings of the market, along with the International Bank of Settlements. Do you think the fact that government interferes so much with markets makes a mockery of the ideology that we really live in a free market economy?
In my personal view, I think there is some degree of government intervention in markets which is required.
I totally agree with you.
But I would still say that on the spectrum of degree of intervention in markets, then in Australia at least, we're towards the
we're one of the lesser ones. And I guess that comes to the next question of, given that our currency, I think, is the fifth most currency, but we've probably got, I think, the 20th biggest economy in the world, are you concerned about the ability of foreign speculators to inflate our currency to more than it's worth? And just foreign interference in terms of currency speculation?
No, I'm not concerned.
Right, okay. That's fine. No worries. I also asked if you could give us a definition of capital, and the RBA replied, capital refers to productive assets, which combined with labour can be used to produce output. I would have thought Finance 101 said capital was defined as debt and equity. That's Finance 101.
I didn't know in what context you were asking what is capital. I mean, Karl Marx wrote a book on it.
Yeah, I get that, but you know, you guys manage the monetary market. So in terms of Treasury, I know you're economists, but you've also got an important role in Treasury, and they're two different skill sets, and it's very important.
I didn't know which context you were asking. I thought you were asking about capital as the Marxian sense, capital and labour rather than...
I guess the definition of capital is someone who's worked a long time, and it's pretty obvious. It's most people who work in finance know that capital is what's used to fund an asset or the purchase of an asset. It's either debt or equity.
That is certainly a definition. Now I know what you're asking.
Like I said, it's one thing to do economic modelling, but you're also involved in serious financial transactions, one of which is the term funding facility, which was introduced last year of up to $200 billion, and that was to basically what I would consider protect authorised deposit institutions. Now that the economy is back on track, Has that been repaid, or how soon do you think that that...
So when the funding we provided under the term funding facility was for 3 years. So sure. From when it's drawn down, the last, at this stage at least, the final draw date is the end of June. So it will be, you know, 3 years from then when it will be repaid. I would characterise the purpose of that is to... of the term funding facility was to provide low-cost funding to the financial system to, and hence to borrowers, both households and businesses, on the back of that. The evidence suggests that's exactly what's happened. We saw borrowing rates come down on the back of that. So I'd say it's working as intended.
Sure. I mean, I'd argue, and this isn't your responsibility, by the way, but if we can find $200 billion to underwrite banks or back them up, we need to find a similar amount of money to build some infrastructure and get the real economy moving as well. As the RBA modelled what the inflation rate would be if it hadn't excluded land from the CPI in 1998?
So we don't make any decisions as to what's included and excluded from the CPI.
That's I realise that, but have you modelled what the inflation rate would be if land hadn't been excluded from the CPI?
No.
Right. Because that, to me, is a big part of when you justify lowering interest rates, you say inflation's low, but yet the CPI doesn't include the cost of existing housing or land. And let's face it, the average price of housing has risen by 7% on average over the last 30 years, mm-hmm. and that's been excluded from inflation. And you have to ask yourself, had that not been excluded from inflation, could you lower interest rates? Because right now, I think we've got the potential of a housing bubble. We've got interest rates right down to, you know, the cash rate's 0.1%. You know, home loans are going for 2%. There's only one way, and that's up from here. So I guess there's a lesson in this: is do we include inflation? The price of existing houses in inflation, and is that something that you should be taking into account when you're lowering interest rates?
Well, I think the answer Dr. DeBell has already given indicates that that's not within the purview of the RBA. But
well, I mean, I know it's not in the definition of inflation, but the fact is that this asset bubble has created a divide between the haves with housing and those who don't have housing.
So we certainly take the effect of our interest rate decisions on house prices as something to we take into account in the setting of our monetary policy decisions. It's some of that is the way that some of the of our policy actions are transmitted.
Sure. So how do we get out of this now? We've got interest rates at 2%. We've got a big housing bubble. Interest rates are going to get up. How are you going to get us out of this?
So I suppose one thing to note, Senator, is if we hadn't provided this stimulus, we'd have a lot higher unemployment. So that's a choice that you have to make, right? Our mandate is to achieve full employment and low inflation. And so if we had higher interest rates, if we did not have as much monetary policy stimulus as we had as we've put in place, we'd be facing considerably higher unemployment than we have at the moment.
Well, I'd argue JobKeeper's done a lot to keep people employed. I mean, regardless of that, interest rates are going to go one way. Well, it's a serious problem.
This is estimates.
I need to get confidence that these guys are going to be able to get us out of it without crashing the housing market and the economy.
This is about asking the officials questions. It's not about debating for them. I'm just...
You've
had a pretty
issue.
Good go. It is. We are short of time.
Yeah. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rennick.
So there you go. And I think what's interesting, firstly, the issue about how do you get out of this mess, right? That's a really, really important question, right? Secondly, the issue of infrastructure investment, you know, just inflating house prices, etc. You know, what about the real economy? Great question. And also the interesting one for me was the CPI. I thought the Reserve Bank was involved in changing the definition of the CPI some time ago, or am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely right. They are being very disingenuous with that answer. And he repeats the same claim with Nick McKim later. This gets to the heart of the matter. Jared explained what the issue is. If land was still included in the CPI, as it was before 1998, the official inflation rate of Australia would have been much higher than the RBA's target rate. It would not have been able to lower interest rates the way it has. And if it wasn't able to lower interest rates the way it did in the last 20 years, you wouldn't have a housing bubble. It's that simple. Now, get this. Think about his answer where he said, we do take house prices into account. Well, I know that to be true. They sit there going, how do we push up house prices? That's how they take them into account, right? He's trying to pretend that there's some kind of factor otherwise. No, Jared was spot on with that line of questioning.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because there are people in the US who basically are saying, you know, if the Fed had actually used the old CPI measure back in 2005, right, they would not have actually messed around with rates the way they did. We wouldn't have had the global financial crisis. We wouldn't have had the massive asset inflation, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is now getting quite fundamentally important, right? Because if we are measuring the wrong thing in the wrong way, then effectively all bank policies are just, well, out the window.
If your measure of inflation, of keeping a low inflation rate, relies on not measuring the things that are inflating, that's fraud. That's what that is. And for the record, Martin, go back to what you said, it was the RBA that lobbied the Australian Bureau of Statistics in 1998 to remove land from the CPI.
Yep.
The RBA did that.
Yep.
Right? So the bell's saying, oh, it has nothing to do with us. Rubbish. You guys, around the same time they got their precious independence, right, they're throwing their weight around saying, take that out of the CPI. What happens? Bang, they invent a housing bubble. And that's become the one trick pony of our economy ever since. So at the next estimates, I expect Jared might be inclined to actually dig into this CPI question even more. Have the documents there from the RBA's lobbying in 1998 and say, explain yourselves.
Absolutely.
Right? Yep. And Guy DeBell will likely say, oh, I wasn't there then.
That's right. It was somebody else who made that decision. But, this is a fundamentally important point, right? If, in fact, areas of the economy are inflating and they're not in the CPI numbers, then the whole policy is actually targeting the wrong thing. And maybe the reason why we've had such low inflation over the last decade plus is simply because it's not being measured right.
Yep, no, that's right. But, and we'll come to this in a minute more with, I think, in response to Nick McKim, but he says it in that discussion with Jared, they fall back on, our responsibility is full employment. And so we have that as a main outcome we have to achieve. Well, first of all, as Jared said, it's a bit rich for you guys to claim credit for the full employment of the last 12 months. They were extraordinary circumstances. A lot of actual fiscal investment by the government there through work cover to do that. I would have said to the RBA, well, how do you define full employment? Mm. Because that's as loose a metric as well, right? Full employment is not 0% unemployment. And they get to basically define it at will. It's not full-time employment. It's so loose a definition. By what actual hard metric is the RBA's performance measured in terms of the real economy? They've skated by for a long time with virtually none.
Absolutely. Well, the whole question of course, how you measure unemployment, right? Anybody who's, worked for an hour is not regarded as unemployed. Well, that's probably a problem. Underemployment's probably a better measure. But the other point there is that there's actually a gap now opening up between Treasury and the Reserve Bank about what the level of unemployment needs to go down to before we actually start seeing, wages growth and inflation, right? And interestingly, the Treasury is sort of saying, well, you know, it's sort of 4.5 to 5, or maybe 5.5. The Reserve Bank the other day, and again, it's being repeated, is talking about a lower rate, right? Now, that gap between those two sort of unemployment targets before things start improving means another 300,000 jobs or not. So this is actually flowing through into real economy outcomes. It means jobs for people versus no jobs for people. And once again, it sounds to me as though this thing is actually, falling apart.
And that reminds me that the US Fed governor, chairman, the current one, said before a US hearing, congressional hearing, not that long ago, that he admitted that the US Fed's definition of full employment is very loose. And frankly, he admitted that the way they defined it had been wrong, And of course, it's a shocking omission, because in the real world, that does translate into hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs, right? And they have this, these central bankers have this acceptable toll, unemployment toll, really, is what they say, 5%, 4%, whatever. That's acceptable unemployment. That's horrific in the real world for the people that are part of. They're by necessity thrown on the scrap heap because the machinery of the financial system that the reserve, that these central banks think they're operating through their levers, says, oh no, that's the exhaust pipe. That's what's going out the exhaust pipe. We need to have that, right? Yep. Doesn't matter that represents lots of lies, lots of poverty, etc. We need to have that, and that's the mental image I have of these guys, Martin. They're operating a machine. Right, and they think they think inflation is a target they want to achieve, and they'll even, I think you mentioned on a show last year or the year before, they'll even welcome high petrol prices, yes, because that'll help them achieve their inflation target. Well, what does that mean in the real world, right? But this is the way these central bankers think. It's very, everything they do is disconnected from the real world.
Yeah, well, it's very Keynesian, of course, which is one of the things that people need to understand. Keynesian, economics is very narrow and very myopic in terms of the way that it thinks about things. And as you say, it's a bit like they pull the levers, and you know, if they pull them just right, they'll get the inflation right and the unemployment right. But if you look at the history over the last 10 years plus, they've failed miserably to hit the targets anytime close. Wages growth has been way lower than they expected. Inflation's been way lower than they expected. And of course, they've taken interest rates now down to ridiculously 0.1%, which of course is why Gerard's question about how do you get back out of this is absolutely the most critical question of all, because there is no example of anywhere around the world where any of this quantitative easing and low interest rate strategy has been reversed effectively.
Well, and then look at the dynamic in the hearing when he was talking like that.
Yep.
Because therein lies the problem.
Yep.
So the chair of this committee is Slade Brockman. He was an acolyte of Matthias Cormann. Matthias Cormann, look where he is now. He's the boss of the OECD. What does that tell you? That tells me, Martin, that Australia's financial establishment is very interlinked with the global financial establishment. If someone like Matthias Cormann can walk from being our longest-serving finance minister straight into that job at the OECD, he's earned his stripes for a certain powerful set that want that.
Yep.
So his acolyte, Slade Brockman, is now the chair of this committee. The previous chair was the notorious senator for banker, Jane Hume, right? He's now there. And when the rubber met the road in that discussion and Gerard got pointed, he stepped in to protect the RBA. It's instinctive with these guys.
Yep.
They are the reason the RBA is the priesthood. People are not because of people like Gerard. People like Gerard are happy to lift up their skirts and see they're wearing no undies, right? They've got no respect for them. It's these other guys that just crawl around the floor and kiss their sandals that give them the power that they have. And of course, then it's not just the RBA that they're worshiping in that way. The RBA is part of the global apparatus of central banks. The late great Jack Lang wrote a book about it called The Big Bust. His experiences in the 1930s when the Bank of England was trying to set up this global network of central banks centered in the Bank of International Settlements, right? And they've achieved it. It's more powerful than governments. And so what you've got is elected senators finally starting to stand up to these unelected, unaccountable banking priests and say, you come clean if that's what's really going on. Like we said, Nick McKim does the same thing in his own way, but it was also pretty pointed.
Yeah, well, we'll move on to McKim in just a second. Just one other final point. It's interesting, of course, that Philip Lowe wasn't there. It was the deputy governor.
It's probably, maybe it's Guy DeBell's initiation, right? Because Philip Lowe, you know, the governor is the top spot, right? Guy DeBell is the top, told, okay, Cohen, go and earn your stripes. You're going to have to deal with this. But then also the other side of it is this the RBA's way of saying, no, you do not, we are not ultimately accountable to you. We will send our deputy, but the main decision maker ain't going to come. And that's something. Now, can I say something about, look, this level of unaccountability, That's entirely in the ball court of the Parliament.
Yes.
They let that happen.
Yep.
And in fact, last year, I think it was, or late the year before, Dr. John Hewson, who in his day, when he was the leader of the Liberal Party, was as ideological a neoliberal as it got, and he argued forcefully for central bank independence, which we didn't have then when he was a leader of the Liberal Party. And of course, then Costello became the treasurer and gave him central bank independence at the same time as Blair gave the Bank of England independence, right, 96, 97. It was about a year or two ago that Dr. John Hewson wrote a column, I think, in The Australian saying, look, this has been a failure. This was an experiment, right? Independence as in unaccountability to the elected government. This was an experiment and it has failed. It's failed miserably. The results, you can just see by their results, what has it achieved? We've actually, globally, we've been in the worst period of financial upheaval for more than half a century in this era, right? Especially the last 10 to 15 years of it. So, yeah, it's up to the Parliament to rein it back in.
Absolutely. And just to underscore again, the Bank for International Settlements isn't unelected, unaccountable cabal of central bankers, right? And the central bankers in each country is effectively unaccountable, unelected. So this whole thing is outside the normal political process, right? And this interface into estimates, right, is about the closest we get in Australia to getting the magnifying glass out and trying to have a look. And, you know, kudos for them actually finally doing that, but they've got a long, long, long way to go to really...
Well, people like... The credit goes to, I believe, Malcolm Roberts for initiating this.
Yes.
I think John Adams had a hand in suggesting that this is what should be done, right? And it absolutely is right. Jared Rennick has obviously jumped on board and said, no, this is the right thing to do. And I'm just what we commented on, that there's now more senators getting involved in this kind of point of questioning. This has become an incredible opportunity.
I agree. And, you know, there are always more questions to ask. Now, let's go on to Nick McKim, right, from the Greens. Remember that McKim wrote a very important comment on the recent bill relating to responsible lending, right, and basically said, you've got to understand what the banks are up to here, right? So he's got a track record of understanding what's really going on. And I think he did pretty well.
I did very well. Let's just play the tape and then I've got a few comments to make.
Great. Here we go.
Thanks, Chair, and good evening, and thanks to both of you for coming in tonight. I wanted to ask some questions about monetary policy, but before I do, just to pick up on your response to one of Senator Walsh's questions about how do we put upwards pressure on wages, and I'm certainly not disputing anything you said, Dr. DeBell, but what about public sector wages? Pretty easy lever for the government to pull. Would you accept that an increase in public sector wages would place... more upward pressure on wages, on private sector wages, than is currently the case?
I'm not sure, to be honest,
okay.
Senator McKim. I mean, what I do know, you know, to answer, going back to what I said to Senator Walsh's question, is a tighter labour market is going to put upward pressure on that. I mean, in the end, it's ultimately a decision for the various governments as to how they want, you know, at the moment there's a fair amount of fiscal stimulus out there. How do they want to provide that? Is that through public sector wages or through something else?
Okay. All right. Thanks. So, to monetary policy, we're in a situation in December to December from 19 to 20. We've got GDP down by 1.1%.
Mm-hmm.
Household spending, consumption down by 2.7%. Business investment down by 5%. Acknowledging the external factors on the economy, but we've got capital city house price growth of 3.6%, and certainly a number of reports that regional house prices are potentially running hotter than capital city house prices at the moment. Do you accept that monetary policy has assisted the speculative sector of the economy, that is house prices, in part house prices, more than it has assisted the productive side of the economy?
I would acknowledge that our actions have had an impact on house prices. So that's certainly the case. Whether more, that I'm not so sure about, because if I look at the transmission of our policy actions, what we have seen, you know, I take your point that investment's down. My argument would be, you know, is the always unknowable counterfactual, is it would be down a hell of a lot more if we hadn't provided the stimulus that we would have. The other thing I'm certain about is if we hadn't provided the stimulus that we have put in place, we would have a lot higher currency than we would have, and that would unambiguously have delivered a much weaker economy, particularly in the traded part of the economy.
Okay.
So I'm not sure I can answer your question as to the more, but is it having an impact? I would argue it's having an impact on both the relative, both parts, both the housing sector and the on investment. The other point I'd note is that, you know, some part of the transmission is not just through prices. It's actually, particularly at the moment, we're seeing a pretty large rise in home building, which is, you know, I don't know, I would describe it as real economic activity, yes, if you want to go down that route. So we are seeing, you know, we are seeing that, and again, some of that is partly the measures that various governments have put in place, including the federal government. Some of it undoubtedly is also the impact of interest rates.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Dr. DeBell. I guess, again, in support of my contention that monetary policy is assisting house prices more than it has assisted productive investment. Got ABS statistics showing January 20 to January 21, lending to households for housing up 44%, lending to business down 19%. So doesn't that again support the contention?
I heard you talking to Megan Quinn about this before. Yeah. So the numbers you're looking at are commitments for new loans. That's, I'm pretty sure, what you're talking about.
I believe that's right, yes.
The actual translation of that through to actual lending. So could I give you, lending for housing total is growing at 3.5% at the moment. So that's the actual provision of new lending.
So
lending
could you break that down for me, Dr. DeBell, sorry, in terms of the difference between...
Just about to, I think.
Carry on. I apologise.
So lending to owner-occupiers is growing at about 5.5%. Lending to investors is actually barely 1% at the moment. It's just gone back into positive territory, having been actually declining through much of 2020. So,
okay.
Was that the question? Is that the breakdown you're after?
Yeah.
Lending to investor lending is just got back into positive territory, just up a little over 2020 as a whole. Like 0.5%, and lending to owner-occupiers is more around 5.5%, has picked up a couple of percent. So the numbers you're looking at there are commitments. The other point I note in those numbers that you just reported comes back to what I was mentioning about home building. So an unusually large share of those new loans were actually loans for new construction. And so that's boosting those numbers. And there was a particularly big spike towards the end of the year as people were getting in ahead of the closure of some of these government support schemes. So there's some reasonable chance that we'd expect those numbers to drop off a bit in the coming months. But in terms of what actually translates through to, you know, into new lending, at the same time we've seen a lot of people paying down their borrowings faster than they have historically too. So that's why the actual lending numbers are growing at a considerably slower pace than what you just said, the commitments numbers, sorry.
Yes.
So we'd still, on the back of those commitment numbers, think credit growth's probably going to get a little faster than what it is at the moment, but not necessarily a lot.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So since the start of the pandemic, the RBA has, I think you call it expanding your balance sheet by $160 billion. Is that about right? Approximately $160 billion?
Sounds about right.
Yep. Now, that's sort of a polite way of saying you've printed $160 billion and injected it into the financial system. Now, not surprisingly, during a recession, the financial system's directing the money towards housing and other asset price speculation more, I guess, in my view, acknowledging your response earlier, than it has directed it to productive investment. Is there anything that the RBA can do other than rely on the financial system to make the decisions about where to transmit the money?
Not really. But what we did do, coming back to the aforementioned term funding facility, is we provided an incentive if you lent to small and medium size enterprises and you got, then we lent more funds under the
term. And what was that incentive, Dr. DeBrun?
It's five times. So if for every dollar increase, so any dollar, for every dollar you lend to small and medium size enterprises, we would lend you five.
I see. Thank you.
So there was a reasonable, you know, and we designed it exactly with that intent to encourage more lending to small and medium-sized enterprises.
So the term funding facility was about a quarter of the expense of your balance sheet, about $40 billion?
Date, that's probably about right.
Yeah, and QE would be the other 120-odd billion. Are those numbers about right?
Yeah. I won't. Yeah, I mean, so what we've...
Approximately.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So...
Bond purchases, sorry, yep.
Okay, yep. In the post-war era, central banks were actually much more prescriptive about where any newly created money was directed. In particular, they used credit guidance to steer central bank money to productive purposes. Is there any impediment to the RBA doing that?
I'm not sure, Senator. I'll have to...
Could I ask you to perhaps have a bit of a think about that and come back on notice?
Yep.
Thank you. Internationally, you've got investment banks being used to direct central bank money to productive ends. In Germany, they've just earmarked 100 billion euros for equity stakes in firms that are fundamentally viable. The UK has recently announced it will re-establish an investment bank. I mean, their options, are they not... either for the RBA or for government.
I suppose in answering your previous question, Senator McKim, is I think by and large, those sort of resource allocations are really decisions for the government, both the directed lending that you were talking about earlier and the sort of thing you're talking about.
Certainly now. An investment bank, I think that's a fair response. Are you suggesting that the RBA wouldn't be able to ensure that some of the money that you are printing is earmarked for things like equity stakes in firms that are fundamentally viable?
I'd hope that all the business lending lending is for businesses which are fundamentally viable.
Yeah, but as opposed to going into the speculative parts of the economy that I was mentioning earlier.
But as I said, I mean, part of, when house prices rise, that incentivizes new home building, right? So there's, notwithstanding that, what I'm saying is those asset price movements, some of which are the result of interest rate movements, are leading to changes in real activity. When households are wealthier, they spend more, which generates more real activity, if you want to put it that way.
Thanks for your engagement, Dr. DeBell. I mean, business loan commitments are growing much faster than housing loan.
No, you mean housing?
Growing much slower, than housing loan commitments, are they not? And I'm trying to...
One question, so we do think about that question a lot as to why that's the case. what we do seem to see, and coming back to our business liaison program, is there's a question around the appetite of businesses to borrow. Putting aside the small business side of things, where I think there is... there's an appetite to borrow, which isn't always met. Certainly on the largest business side of things, that seems to be more one of lack of willingness to borrow rather than lack of willingness to lend. That's the general sense we get from talking to both sides of that transaction.
So has the RBA examined at all the efficacy of investment banks as a vehicle to direct monetary policy to productive ends, or any other ways in which monetary policy could be better directed to more productive ends?
Correct me if I get this wrong, Michelle, but the government has recently looked at this.
Yep.
They've set up this vehicle. I'm going to get the acronym wrong here.
This is the there's two programs. There's a program that the banks are involved in, which is about equity financing for small businesses. And then the government's also set up another program, which I can't remember the acronym either, but that's basically meant to invest in Securitise
Which the AOFM is running. Which the AOFM is running.
Yeah. So and that, that's basically going to be built up. It was, I think it was, it was put on hold while COVID was on, but I think it's back on again now. And I think what they're doing now is going to, they're going to ramp it up gradually over time.
Those two programs are sort of along the lines of what you're talking about.
Could I just ask you to, on notice, provide any other, perhaps a little bit more detail about those programs?
Yep.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And the last question from me, Chair. Thank you. I guess I wanted to put to you, Dr. DeBell, the proposition that we are rapidly reaching the end of the efficacy of monetary policy. You've got interest rates near to zero. You're printing, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. This seems to be feeding the speculative side of the economy more than the productive side. Wages are stagnant. Why don't you just bell the cat and say we can't keep doing this? I guess, and what I'm asking you, what's the end game?
Well, the end game is hopefully full employment, and
We all hope that. But
if you want to make your comparison, I would say we're a lot closer to that now than we were 6 months ago. And while in some part of that, I would attribute to the impact of monetary policy. By no means, all of that. So what I would say is that I think we can make some case the fact that the policy actions that have been taken to date on the monetary side, as well as obviously the fiscal side and just the playing out of the virus itself, have led to an economy, we've led to an economy which is much closer to where we would like to be than where we feared we might have been 12 months ago. Attribute a little bit of that to monetary policy. So I'd say that we probably haven't completely run out of efficacy yet.
But many of those factors were in before the pandemic. Thanks very much for your engagement.
Right, so there you go. I'd give him a 9.5 out of 10.
Yep. No, he was well prepared, Nick McKim, and he stuck to his theme. Right, he had a theme, and he stuck to it. What are you doing for the real economy? Everything you're doing is only benefiting one part of the economy, which is housing speculation. Now, you may have recognised those figures better than me, Martin, but I got the impression that Guy DeBell did not like the figure where lending to housing has climbed 44%, lending to business has dropped 19%, and he tried to reduce it to that's new approvals.
That's the flow of new approvals, and then said, "Well,
that's
of course,
the flow of new approvals,
real loans might not be as good," because there is a difference between a loan being approved and a loan actually being drawn down, right?
And I think, but it's the 3.5% that he came back to.
Yep.
That is the total pool of credit for housing growing by 3.5%.
So what he's doing is incorporating, obviously, all the new loans, the existing loans, and the loans that are being paid down, right? So we know that there are a lot of people who are paying down their mortgages really, really fast because they're concerned about some of the risks in the economy, and they've had this money from the government, so it makes a lot of sense. So the net loan growth, which is three point something, is still quite low relative, right? But the point is that the flow of new credit, right, for housing has gone through the roof, particularly first-time buyers, even investors now, whereas new credit for business has gone absolutely backwards, and in fact the net growth for business is also down compared with previously. So it shows that this focus on just housing as the sort of the engine of the economy, which is what the Reserve Bank and the Council of Financial Regulators and everybody else is, the Treasury, is all doing, right, is missing the point. This is not real investment by real businesses into the real economy. This is just creating this sort of artificiality around wealth from inflated house prices, from inflated mortgage lending, right? And this is, of course, before the responsible lending changes were due to come in, right? And, of course, that got sort of postponed the other week because of the Senate saying, hang on a moment, this doesn't make a lot of sense. So, kudos again to the Senate here. But
now, Nick McKim led that fight back against responsible lending.
Absolutely, and the debate actually on the floor of the Senate was actually pretty good around that too. So, so that they are understanding that this is actually a very myopic strategy, right? In terms of, it might top line improve GDP a little bit, and it, gives the banks more profitability, and they can grow their balance sheets. But it's not into the real economy, and that's the whole point.
Well, and then let's drill down into that, because this is where I think Debelle was at his most explicitly Keynesian. He admitted, one, there's no actual way that the Reserve Bank has no actual way to direct where the credit goes. So he basically tried to talk up the wealth effect, right? The lending is going to, he's not that explicit, but that's what he was saying. From the overall pool of lending going into the economy, wherever it goes, it leads to a flow on into the economy. And then he said almost lamely out of the corner of his mouth that construction is the real economy too. And of course, yes, it is. But that is the one, this is the biggest credit, that is the one trick pony they've got.
Yeah.
They have this idea, because I suppose there's a certain flexibility with housing construction in terms of starting and stopping. They have this idea, pour the money in there, if it'll sop up spare labour, right, quickly, and just keep those houses being built. But what does that mean, though, in the real world? Not only does it mean, one, you have to expose yourself to a bubble for longer, which will eventually come down at a certain point. Some of those houses get built in floodplains. That's what it means. They're underwater now. And this is all they know how to do. So forget the floods. Forget the financial payday, like the financial reckoning day at the end. We're going to think short term. We have one trick. Let's just flood the housing market again.
Yeah, and absolutely. And if you want to see where that plays too, just look at what happens in New Zealand, right? So New Zealand was reporting a house price growth of something like 26%, and they actually announced yesterday and the day before a whole bunch of measures to try and actually turn the housing sector down. And it's worth actually looking at my show I did on that, because it's a really interesting development, a very significant development in my view. We should be learning from that, because we're going the same way as New Zealand, which is just basically pump up houses, pump up lending, keep interest rates really low, encourage more investors to buy more properties. You know, a whole bunch of people in New Zealand have bought multiple investment properties. This is not the real economy, folks. And that is what was so interesting about McKim's contribution to the debate. And as you know, my sense was Debelle really had no answer to it.
No, he didn't. Now, McKim raised the question of this, you know, what it's in the power of the Reserve Bank to do to direct this money, though.
Yep.
And Debelle basically said, not really. They had a certain incentive for small business lending. I can't remember the details of that. I remember looking at it last year. It was pretty poor. Whatever their incentive was, the results were still very, very poor. I think they had put aside 40 billion and maybe 1.8 billion was used, something like that. I remember it was very poor. So even though there was an incentive, that wasn't enough to encourage the banks enough in that direction. So McKim raised investment banks, and of course this is something that's dear to our heart, because you've got to take charge and go, okay, what do we want our economy to be? Let's invest in it. There's no lack of money for investing. It's just where you're putting it, right? Well, what did he say to that? He said, this is the one thing he said I agree with. He said that's up to the government.
Yeah.
And it's true. Now, the government could just take control back of the Reserve Bank and say, okay, you're going to be our national bank. We're going to do it through you. That's one way. And we've got actually a bill sitting there that would do that. That's it's called the Commonwealth National Credit Bank Act. We'd turn the Reserve Bank back into our national bank, so it does both functions at the same time. That's just on the back burner for now. But the government can set up dedicated investment banks to do that through, which the Reserve Bank can provide the credit for, but the investment banks, and they can be specific, they have specific expertise in those banks, right? Specific to agriculture, specific to manufacturing, specific to, you know, infrastructure, etc. And the people who are the staff are not just financial experts, but they're experts in the field, right? So you're making the right decisions, and you're not wasting money, but you can craft it around flexibility that the private banks would never have, etc. And at the end of the day, you'd be miles ahead. I did an interview on our show with the former deputy director of the Ministry of Finance of Japan, Daisuke Kotagawa, about how Japan's postal savings bank was so instrumental to its economic success post-World War II because it provided money for these dedicated investment banks, right? And they did the heavy lifting to actually improve the economy. We desperately need something like that now. And the Reserve Bank governor, that part is right. He actually doesn't have the specific power to do that. It's up to the government. And this is the political change we have to create.
Absolutely. Well, I'll leave you with two other thoughts before we move into our first third segment. The first is the way to actually deal with lending for business versus houses is to reverse the capital ratios, right? It's four times more efficient for banks to lend at the moment for mortgages than for small business, right? Turn that on its head and you'd suddenly find that banks will be falling over themselves to lend to small business. So that's a relatively easy fix. And it's something which, by the way, APRA could do. Or the Council of Financial Regulators, that's Philip Lowe's other brain, right? Which includes...
Technical question, would that be in defiance of Basel?
Well, it would certainly be changing, but the whole point about Basel comes top down, right? You've got local authority to sort of flex it for your local economic environment. The fact of the matter is that those ratios have driven massive amounts of lending globally into housing, right? Because it's so much more capital efficient. The other interesting observation is that, of course, New Zealand is basically dominated by four Australian banks. You know, they've got 85% of the market. It's interesting that Westpac yesterday said they might pull out from New Zealand. The one below those big four is Kiwi Bank, right? And Kiwi Bank, of course, was a bank created out of New Zealand Post, right? So there's an opportunity. You can see how that could play out in New Zealand, and suddenly Kiwi Bank could get on a bit of a wriggle and become a more dominant player within the New Zealand market again. So once again, drawing some interesting connection points between banking, post, Australia Post, and all of those things that we've spoken about before. There is lots of stuff that could be done if there was a willingness to do it.
I was contacted by people in New Zealand who have watched the successes we've been having on this side of the ditch. They would like to do something on their home front. And I said to them, well, you know, our success is based around actual engagement in the political process, not just through demoralisation, vacating the field and letting the vested interests have it. Because once the public do engage, the politicians have to pay attention. And the more you engage, the more attention they have to pay. So there is lots of scope for local action in New Zealand around. That's one of the things we talked about. They've got Kiwi Bank there, right? It's also the solution to their for Kiwis personally to their bail-in threat, because they've got the most explicit bail-in system in the world. We'll put your money in Kiwi Bank because the government owns it. It's not going to go under.
Yep.
But use it to bring back the industry that New Zealand needs, so it stops being this one-trick pony as well. Our banks. Sometimes I don't forget that New Zealand's banks are our banks, but it's good to be to remember that, have it at the forefront of your mind, because they're very powerful in Australia. They're no doubt powerful in New Zealand, and the relationship between these big four banks and the central banks, all it seems to have achieved in both countries is property bubbles.
Yep, agree with that. Well, let's just move on quickly to Matt Cavan. His line of questioning was also very interesting. Let's just play a little bit of this.
I just want to ask about the yield curve control policy.
Yep.
And correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is the attempt here is to keep the short-term part of the yield curve down to set expectations that the RBA is seeking to keep interest rates down for, I think it's around 3 years or so. Is that maybe just to clarify that right?
The three-year yield
target.
Yep.
My understanding is, though, that interest rates in swap markets or derivatives aren't really reflecting that
swap
policy.
Curve is higher than the bond curve.
Yes, so there is perhaps an expectation that the RBA will raise rates within that 3-year window. Is that correct? Is that the phenomenon you're seeing in markets?
Yep.
Does this mean, though, that then the yield curve control policy has failed?
No, I don't think so. If I look at a lot of reason why we chose to target the 3-year yield curve is because a lot of interest rates price off that part of the curve, or shorter in Australia. Australia is very much a floating rate economy rather than something, you know, in comparison to the US, where a lot of stuff prices off the 10-year part of the curve. So that's why we chose to target the 3-year part of the curve. You're right that the swap curve is higher than where the 3-year bond rate is at the moment, but I would also argue that it would be a hell of a lot higher than where it is currently if we didn't have that 3-year yield curve target in place. So the swap, you know, the swap curve is higher, but it's not massively high. If I look at our curve relative to, you know, we've seen a similar dynamic play out in a number of countries over the last couple of months in terms of the market starting to price rises tightening in policy sometime in the next later next year or the following year. But I would argue that and we've seen this in borrowing rates, which have come down, which is, you know, for both households and businesses, which is ultimately the transmission through to the real economy, that they have come down with the combination of the 3-year yield target, the term funding facility also for 3 years. So I'd say that it is working.
But what's the point of the policy then? Because if you didn't seek to suppress the bond yield curve, the 3-year bond yield curve, and instead, or didn't distort it really, I suppose. You correct me if I'm using the wrong terms here, but there's a level of government intervention that's distorting it away from where it would be if it was naturally set by the market. So I'm using distort in those terms. Wouldn't the bond curve just go back to the probabilistic expectations of interest rates going up, and that at least would provide undistorted information to the market rather than this artificial attempt to keep things down, which is not even flowing through to the swap curve?
Right, but I'd say it's flowing through to lending rates. Yes, the swap curve is higher than that. I would argue that, so the 3-year, we have said that we will not be raising the cash rate, we've said this repeatedly, until we see inflation sustainably back in the 2-3% range. And on our current expectation is that won't be until 2024 at least. And the 3-year bond yield is I would view that as just reinforcing that our view of the world. Now, the market can take a different view. They're entitled to do that, but that's our view of the world. The three-year yield curve target, completely backs that up. And as I said, it is translating through to lower...
But the 3-year yield curve... You're setting that, aren't you? That's not you've targeted that.
No, but that's what I said. You're targeting that 3-year yield curve.
The 3-year yield curve is not
putting our money where our mouth is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but it's not.
Backing up.
It's not evidence of the market accepting or believing your assessment of the future. It's effectively the 3-year yield curve is effectively being set by the policy of the RBA.
Historically, we've set the overnight cash rate.
Yep.
And now
you're setting a 3-year,
which is our expectation that the overnight cash rate is still going to be at 10 basis, that is 10 basis points in 3 years is...
Isn't there a risk here, though, that you'd be putting at risk the credibility of the RBA by sort of saying your expectation is that rates won't change for 3 years? Obviously, the market doesn't believe you at the moment. And I would have thought one of the most dangerous things a central bank can put themselves into is that they lose they become unmoored to the expectations of the market.
Well, the market sometimes has a different view from us, sometimes it doesn't. I think in the end, what we're asked to do is achieve the objectives we've been asked to achieve for the Australian people, not the markets.
I accept that, but you're obviously in charge of the tools with which you meet that objective.
Right, so we set our tools to try and achieve those objectives. We are not infallible by any means, but we set, we use our best judgment to assess what...
I suppose my concern here is
that policy settings to achieve those objectives that we've been asked to achieve.
My concern here is that your expectation, you've gone out and said you think yields or your interest rates should be at this level for 3 years, the market doesn't believe you at the moment. What happens in the future if there's inflation and we need to contract that, and you need to credibly go out there and say you're going to contract the money supply? I'm worried you've lost some credibility in the market here through this policy, that you won't be able to credibly signal contraction to get inflation under control.
In all fairness, Senator, and my experience, we've had various stages where the market expected us that we would have to raise rates considerably more than we had to do at various stages, and we haven't done that. Sometimes they've expected us to be lowering rates and that hasn't proven to be subsequently necessary. Are we always going to get it right? No, that's certainly not the case. But as I said, we have to make our best judgment. I don't know that we have much choice, but we have to make our best judgment to set what we feel is the most appropriate policy settings given the circumstances we find ourselves in.
How do interest rate expectations here in Australia compare with the USA or New Zealand or other countries at the moment?
I mean, it's changed a lot in the last 2 weeks, but as of today, there's not too much difference in it. I think today, there's probably a slight chance that the US will tighten policy a little sooner than what it is here, but that's moved a fair bit in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Done?
Yep.
So move on?
Yep.
You go with our thanks.
Okay, thank you.
So there you go. Again, I felt pretty impressive.
Yeah, now this is technical stuff that he's talking about, but it's getting to the heart of, are you sure RBA, with this game you're playing with the yield curve, targeting the 3-year yield curve and keeping it low, are you sure that, you know, this is one, going to be successful, and two, even in raising that question, Matt Canavan is getting to the mechanics of this whole QE system anyway, right? Where, because he pointed out that, and you'd probably know the understand it better than I, Martin, but the swap interest rate is higher than the 3-year yield curve rate. That's a sign that interest rates could go up.
Yep.
But then he also raised the big one was inflation.
Yep.
Right? You know, because don't pretend there is no inflation. So if suddenly inflation rears its ugly head, you guys, the Reserve Bank's going to be caught really, really flat-footed. And what can it do? And this whole thing can get it out of control very fast. And bang, we're in a global financial crisis. And Mr. DeBell looked pretty uncomfortable under that questioning.
Yeah, I thought he did. In fact, I think he was probably most uncomfortable at that point because it was fundamentally questioning the underlying doctrine which is behind everything they're doing, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, implicitly, that's questioning not just Australia, but it's questioning also what the Fed is doing in the US, what the Eurozone is doing, what the Bank of England is doing, and the Bank of Japan. So it is fundamentally asking the really important question, which is, is this quantitative easing stuff that you're doing and really low interest rate stuff really going to get us to where we need to get to, right? And, you know, I think probably you and I have the sense, Robbie, that they'll just go on doing more of it and more of it and increasing the momentum. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily indicate it's going to get to where they want it to get to. And in fact, some of them, like in the Fed, they've been at it for a long, long time, and it still hasn't really happened. Japan, of course, is the best example of you know, worst case, 30 years pretty much of negativity in terms of the performance. So it really does get to the heart of the issue.
Well, and just to that, the alarming thing is what a year ago the Fed spokesperson, Lael Brainard, said then. And she has a position now in the Biden administration. But she basically said, well, quantitative easing was an experiment after the global financial crisis. We didn't know if it'd cause inflation or not. It was so much money we thought it probably might cause inflation. It didn't. So that was the only potential downside. So it worked. So we're going to keep using it.
Yep.
And inflation to quantitative easing to infinity or whatever the expression was. They do not have to look at the real world here,
yep.
Right? And so the things like targeting the yield curve is the mechanics of how they do it. And this is the equivalent of the priesthood stuff where someone walks in up to the priest and he's got all the steam coming out of some magical thing that everyone worships and whatever, and he just turns it, opens it up, and you know, that just shows the whole world this is the little trick you're playing on everybody.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
What impact are you having in the real world? What mistakes are you potentially making here? Because never with any elite, Martin, never make the mistake of assigning to them, excessive intelligence, right? Power and intelligence are not hand in hand. There's often, you know, real blind spots in the way they operate. And yeah, but the significance is the questions themselves.
Yes.
Right? You've got a senator going in there and saying, you explain your actions here. And the Reserve Bank would not be used to that.
Absolutely. And I think that's really the point. You know, kudos to all of those who ask questions. And we would like to see a lot more of that, because I think it is time for the Reserve Bank and the other regulators to be much more accountable. And, you know, just hiding behind that mystique, as you say, it's the priesthood, you know, sort of you pull the curtains closed and they all do it over there and nobody knows what they're doing. Well, we're starting now to actually roll the curtains back. And what you discover is that the priesthood is actually a little bit less shiny than we might think, right? It doesn't necessarily have all the answers. And interestingly, when you start asking some very sensible, logical questions, what you discover is that there are deficiencies in their thinking, and some very, very narrow thinking too. And interestingly, you know, more generally, that is often the case with regard to the priesthood. So it's all very interesting.
Oh, my understanding, Martin, is that the famous Oracle of Delphi at the Temple of Apollo in Greece was one of, you could think of it as the world's first central bank, because the kings would come there and they consulted the oracle on everything they did, including whether to go to war with each other. The same kings deciding whether to go to war would come and consult the oracle. Of course, the oracle had to be translated. Apparently, she was some woman on drugs, suspended over a pit, right, with all this steam coming up and just babbling. And the priests, of course, would do the translation of what she's saying. And the kings would pay for the service, and they built up such a treasury that then they were able to also loan to the kings for their wars, right? And they were this, like, the central bank of ancient Greece, the Grecian Empire. And this is the model, right? We need to think in terms of another historic reference, that what Jesus Christ did to the money changers in the temple, right? Okay, there's a role for bankers, right? Kept on a leash, they're fine, right? But you don't let them run the show, and that's what the central banking model's got to be brought down. And anyway, these are the first signs. They're actually good signs. And like I said, I hope people who've watched this realize, if you do get to, you know, the media doesn't cover this sort of thing enough, right? These nuances are actually a big deal.
Yep.
There are quite seismic political shifts underway in Australia. We're part of the force that's making that happen, right? We're providing scrutiny. We're providing public pressure. It's translating into something. This, what you've seen from this hearing to the previous one, is growing momentum now, right? More interest in asking these guys questions. Someone at the RBA is going to watch this video and suggest that they never appear before Senate estimates again, now that we're gloating about it, but whatever. It's up to the senators to fight for him to come. But yeah, let's provide all the scrutiny we can and watch them sweat, and that's how you're going to make the changes we need.
Absolutely, Robbie. Well, I appreciate your time today. A very, very important video. And once again, I do congratulate all the senators who asked the harder questions. I think there are a whole lot more questions that we could probably accumulate and throw in their direction for future events. But it does show that this is now greater transparency, greater openness, and, you know, that could lead us somewhere quite exciting down the track. So thanks again, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Sure will. Thanks, Martin.
Thanks. Take care.